Your life, as it exists right now, is insignificant, isolated, fractured, and cannot be saved.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 183, Back to Surrender Again, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, December 9th, 2009. And in this installment of the podcast, I'm going to be playing the final portion of my conversation with Jason Horsley. It's just about 15 minutes long. And then the rest of the episode will be filled with my meanderings and musings. And for those of you who like the Sea Realm podcast but don't much care for the doom and gloom aspect of it, this episode might prove a bit of a challenge for you, but I hope you won't turn it off right now, because I think, hopefully, if you listen to it with an open mind and an open heart, you will see that the doom and gloom element of the Sea Realm podcast is not, in fact, doom and gloom. But rather than try to telegraph that message, which will unfold over the course of about 20 minutes, I think, let me thank the sponsors of this week's episode. They include Kevin D., Patrick B., Mariah C., and Zymoni.com. And there are some repeat sponsors in there. You've heard me thank Zymoni.com on many occasions. Let me just spell that out for you. Z, or Z for you Commonwealth folks, AIMONI.COM, Zymoni.com. And thanks again to Kevin, Patrick, and Mariah. Mariah, a repeat sponsor of the Sea Realm podcast. Now, at the beginning there, you heard a very short clip from Doug Lane reading from his short story, How to Cut Your Life to Pieces, and he read that entire story in Diet Soap episode number 34, and I'm going to be playing about 2 minutes worth of that a little later in the podcast. Also, as usual, the Sea Realm podcast this week features some music, and this week's music is by Jesse Miller. Also, I use music by Richard Grossman and Glud, as I have many times in the past. Now, usually I get right into the interview material for the sake of the people who tuned into this episode just to hear that particular guest. But Jason Horsley fans, you can either try to skip ahead or just grit your teeth and put up with some Sea Realm content for the next few minutes, because I'm going to read a letter that I received in response to the recent conversation that I had with Salo Stanley. Salo Stanley is a chiropractor, but she is also a psychic and a healer, and somebody who uses sound in healing. And this is well outside the usual scope of the Sea Realm podcast, and I was a bit nervous about that conversation, as I really don't want to be labeled and dismissed as a New Ager. And, well, the letter that I'm about to read addresses that very concern. This is from John C., and John, along with Justin Ritchie, were two Sea Realm listeners who participated in my first interview with Charles Eisenstein. That was in the spring of 2009. I don't have the exact episode ready to hand. And John's letter came as an email, of course, and the subject line was A Message from La La Land. And John C. writes, KMO, I bestir myself to beam some words of encouragement your way regarding your recent rather delightful interview with Salo Stanley. You mentioned several times being uneasy about taken as a New Ager. I associate that term mostly with elevator music, so being curious, I looked it up. According to Wikipedia, the New Age movement is a decentralized Western social and spiritual movement that seeks universal truth and the attainment of the highest individual potential. It includes aspects of cosmology, astrology, esotericism, alternative medicine, music, collectivism, sustainability, and nature. New Age spirituality is characterized by an individual approach to spiritual practices and philosophies, and the rejection of religious doctrine and dogma. Other definitions I looked at are generally similar. I'm not sure what universal truth is, but that one quibble aside, I dare guess that most of your listeners are already New Agers, or moving in that direction, based on that definition. We all know that one tool of control in our culture, either intentionally or emergently, is to discredit a term and then apply that term to people who might not be drinking their full quota of the cultural Kool-Aid. Okay then, if New Age isn't really pejorative, let's go with airy-fairy. Nobody likes to be associated with that term. I know you are quite familiar with the incomprehensible yet incontrovertible quirks of quantum mechanics. It seems that a logical and unbiased person who thinks seriously about these things must ineluctably adopt an agnostic, in the literal sense of unknowing, worldview. Unless I am greatly mistaken, that is where you are these days. We will probably never unravel the mysteries hidden in that great, murky sea of unknowingness, but I say, let's enjoy splashing about and just ignore those jeering at us from their tiny concrete islands of desperate certainty. You never know what we may find. I am a card-carrying scientist with a PhD in geophysics, and I have spent more than my fair share of time in the company of other scientists of various types. Still, I never bought into the scientific fundamentalist mindset that denies everything that can't be proven by replicated experiments and mathematics. Even early in my career, I was determinedly agnostic about nearly everything, but strongly doubted the airy-fairy stuff. After years of reading and reflection, and listening to podcasts like yours, I now strongly lean towards, yes, I admit it, thinking that a substantial portion of the airy-fairy stuff might in fact be real, whatever that means. So let's not sweat the labels, denigrated by the forces of cultural regimentation. This kind of nasty game is burning up too much of our mental resources, and we can't win. We need to rise above these annoying cultural games and devote our attention to the mysteries lurking in the sea of unknowingness. This is truly fascinating stuff worthy of our attention. In closing, KMO, I say kudos to Salo Stanley and her adventurous life choices. I greatly enjoy her story and your interaction, and thanks to you for your continuing good work and your open mind. Cheerfully yours from La La Land, John C. P.S. Having in recent years beat to death some grim real-world topics like resource scarcity and economic collapse, much of my intellectual energy these days is invested in exploring airy-fairy topics. I recently read Supernatural by Graham Hancock and When the Impossible Happens by Stan Grof. They are quite different, but I found both to be excellent. Very airy-fairy, while at the same time being carefully reasoned with extensive endnotes and or references that have led me to another dozen books for my reading list. You may already be on top of the topics in these books, but I learned a lot and recommend them. Well, John C., thank you very much. I have read Supernatural by Graham Hancock, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I have not read When the Impossible Happens. The only book by Stan Grof that I have read is The Holotropic Universe, which I enjoyed, and I have enjoyed some of the Stan Grof presentations that I've heard on the Psychonautica podcast, but I haven't read any of his other books, although I would like to. But life being full of challenges and demands on my time, I don't get through a lot of books, really. Sad to say, I read more than most people, I think, but not nearly as much as I would like. I will be talking about a couple of books that I've read recently, and in particular, in this week's episode, you're going to hear a lot about and from a book called Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse by Carolyn Baker, PhD. The two most recent nonfiction books that I have read are Sacred Demise by Carolyn Baker and The Ecotechnic Future by John Michael Greer, and I enjoyed The Ecotechnic Future immensely. I won't be reading from it or talking about it this week, although I think the content of it will probably shape a good deal of what you hear both on the C-Realm podcast and for those of you lucky enough to attend the speaking tour that I'll be doing with Neil Kramer in the coming weeks. John Michael Greer has an excellent way of popping some delusional bubbles, and some of those delusions are ones that I myself succumb to. So it's always a good, refreshing, brisk bucket of cold water over the head to read John Michael Greer's work. Well, so there we are, with the fear of the New Age label sticking to me shed like the skin of a snake, I now slip into the final portion of my interview with Jason Horsley.
You're listening to the C-Realm podcast. C stands for consciousness.
No, out by the Delta forces and taken to relocation centres, you know, to have our brains fried by the New World Order, and there'd be part of us that is okay with that.
Well, let's change tracks a little bit. You apprenticed under a shaman, and you have considerable experience with what some people call psychedelics, other people call entheogens, and other people just call psychedelic drugs or just drugs. And I have heard you express a strong reservation about their use. If you would talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's back to surrender again, I'm afraid, because it's the knowing I have now is that for me, or for anyone to use psychedelic drugs, is to invest in our own awakening. And so the only reason we invest in something is because we think there's something in it for us. So to use psychedelics as a means to tune into galactic consciousness or to accelerate our mutation, whatever, you know, whatever the justification is, it's still something that we are doing for ourselves. It's a kind of pain relief. And because we want to be in alternate states of consciousness where all of our problems go away. And I don't care who you are and how you spin it, you know, there's going to be an element of this if you go out seeking these substances and use them. So my trouble was that, and still is, you know, when it comes to talking about this, is that on the other hand, if these substances come to you, they're definitely there for a purpose and a reason. And if they come to you in a way that really is spontaneous and organic, and particularly if a shaman or somebody who really does know what he's doing introduces you to that, then it can be an opportunity which is vital, an opportunity to actually integrate areas of our unconscious by bringing them into consciousness. I think this is what psychedelics do. They allow us to journey into our unconscious, bring forth some of that disowned matter into the light of consciousness and integrate it. Now, so then the question is, you know, everybody has a psychedelic experience. If it's a powerful one, they get to see realities, perceptions that are totally new to them. But what they're really seeing is, whether it's, you know, going into their DNA, whether it's going into their unconscious, what they're really seeing is parts of themselves that have been concealed from them until then. So then the question is how can they integrate those experiences into their daily lives? That, to me, is the acid test. And my experience has been that for the 10 psychedelic experiences I had, probably 9 of them were superfluous because of what I said, that I was doing them because I just wanted to have these transcendental experiences to kind of blow myself out of the waters of my ordinary life and into some other stratosphere. And so after a time when I realized that I'd gone as far as I needed to go, and I reached a point where it was too much for me, you know, the experiences I was having were just too much and I was starting to lose the plot. And so then I knew that it was time to back off. But then over the years that followed, I realized very palpably how hard I'd made it to live my life, how hard these experiences had made it for me just to live an ordinary daily existence, because I'd been given a glimpse into these other realms of reality and these other areas of my psyche that were so vast and fascinating and spellbinding, and they'd given me this idea that I was somehow different from other people, and that there was a whole other reality that I existed in, and if I could only get back to it. And I'm sure you're familiar with all these feelings. So basically, I felt like life at an ordinary level was devoid of any meaning or interest. And so I won't say that that led to depression, because the, you know, depression has many causes, and I'm sure that I would have gone through many years of depression even without the psychedelics, but I think that that definitely compounded the problem.
Well, I agree with much of what you've said. I mean, I talk about psychedelics quite often on this program, but I don't actually do them very often. Mm. Although I was a little bit surprised to hear you describe psychedelics as something that, you know, would allow one to escape one's problems, because I've, in my experience, particularly on like sub-threshold doses of psychedelics, my problems or my perception of my problems or my negative judgments about myself loom much, much larger in my consciousness than they do in ordinary consciousness.
This is true, but there's something that, I mean, don't they also become sort of transpersonal, that one's problems become so magnified that they no longer seem like small personal problems, but like cosmic dilemmas?
Or one, you know, that's why I specified the sub-threshold dose, because if one gets the really effective dose where one is not able to resist, you know, the course of the experience, then one is shown processes which are so huge and so universal and so significant that one's individual personal problems seem completely trivial.
Yeah.
I'm interested in psychedelics. I'm fascinated by them because they do obviously have this, you know, this potential to change one's consciousness dramatically in a very short time. And I think on a large scale, that's probably something that is desirable, you know, a radical change of consciousness. But at the same time, a lot can go wrong. And one, I mean, I've had people who, friends in my life, you know, who swear off psychedelics after some really terrifying experiences that haunt them for years.
Hmm.
And, also, one can come under the sway of some, you know, some really loony thought forms. If, you know, people have this experience of epiphany, you know, they put together thoughts in a novel way when under the influence of psychedelics, and then they make the mistake of thinking, ah, this is how things really are. And if one, you know, forms some attachment to this novel worldview and is then unable to reconnect at all with consensus reality and consensus concerns, then really one becomes sort of a burden on the group just because of their inability to engage with others in a meaningful way.
Yeah, well, and in the community generally, the psychedelics would only be used by the shaman, and then the shaman would only use them when he was working on the patient. Sometimes shamans do give psychedelics to the patient to help with the cure, certainly if the shaman has an apprentice, which is my experience, apprenticing under a shaman and being administered the red pill, as I put it, which was DMT, that was definitely part of a tradition, let's say, so some organic process that I think these plants are there for. As I say, for integrating aspects of the unconscious that we've disowned, be one way of putting it. But that's very different. I mean, a shaman is somebody who, if they're true, if they're effective shamans, they're surrendered beings, at least when they're on as shamans. They're not necessarily that way the whole time, but a shaman is a vessel for transpersonal forces, for spirits and what have you. And so then the shaman administering a substance would be acting as a vessel for that substance itself, like this, which is part of the consciousness of the earth, which then wants us to ingest it so that we can commune with the earth and with the, maybe with the whole system that we're part of, the whole galaxy. Who knows? But it's, my point is, it's not up to us to decide when we do that. It's, again, it's this unspoken, unthought out assumption that we can have any existence that's separate from the system that we're part of, and that we're somehow, because we're endowed with self-consciousness, we get to put our hands on the wheel and we get to decide what we need and when to do it. And And so now anyone can be a shaman, you know, they just do a few courses, they get themselves a batch of ayahuasca, they get the blessing of some possibly real but most likely dodgy shaman who tells them that they're a shaman, and so this propagates this, you know, it's like I was saying with the environmental movement, everything becomes part of consensus reality because that's the morphogenetic field. So shamanism and psychedelic or power plants, healing, initiation, these are, you know, this global awakening, supposed, so-called, it seems to me more like what we saw in the 60s and the 70s with punk, which is a genuine movement, but as soon as it happens, it gets hijacked by the consensus. The morphogenetic field of consensus reality assimilates it very quickly. And so then we get this surrogate thing. And I think the psychedelic community, well, I mean, even at a course level, I'm quite sure it's been infiltrated by the intelligence community. How could it not be? And so then it's being subtly directed. But there's more to it than that. It's, as I say, there's a much bigger process going on. And I think that that's our Achilles heel, really, is that as long as we're under this delusion that we can have a separate existence and a separate agenda where we get to decide, then we're not really opening to what is. Because, I mean, psychedelics, you know, where do we get this idea? Even what you said earlier, that awakened consciousness seems to be what people need, where does that idea come from? Even that's an assumption, really, isn't it? Because why would we ever think that the universe needs anything that isn't happening anyway? You see what I mean? I mean, the universe, we know that the universe can take care of itself, and it is a process unto itself. So at what point does it need our input is the question that I would ask about this. And the answer seems to be that the only point that we're really able to collaborate with the universe is when we're fully surrendered to it. So we have no agendas of our own. And that's how shamans operate, and that's why shamans are very rare, because who wants to surrender all their agendas? Who is able to? It's something that only comes about, I think, and this is from my experience with shamans and with myself, that when we're totally and utterly broken as people, when we've just lost everything, we've lost all will to live and all desires and all hopes for ourselves, and then we can actually become vessels because we've got nothing left to hold on to. I don't think there's any other way in our culture. I think if you're born into a culture where shamans, you know, that's very different, because, well, we're talking about a totally different kind of culture in which the idea of the personal self, the sovereign self, hadn't taken precedence anyway. But we live in a culture and a world where the idea of personal sovereignty is paramount. That's basically, you know, the essence of how we live, is that we matter. This assumption that we matter as individuals. In our older cultures, that hadn't come all the way into being, because there was the life of the community took precedence over the individual. So, but I think in our current mindset of the sovereign self, the only way to really be in service to what is to be totally broken down. And I guess psychedelics can do that. As you say, they can be terrifying experiences, as they've been for me. The experiences that were truly, I don't know what the word is, that seemed necessary to me, they were devastating. You know, I barely recovered from them, but I did recover, and I'm certainly glad that they happened.
Well, I think we'll probably have to leave off there. But Jason Horsley, thank you very much for participating on the CROM podcast, and I wish you the best.
Yeah, thanks, Gamma. It was fun talking to you.
You're listening to the CROM podcast. Your mind, one week at a time.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm talking with Eric Davis, and we've been talking about the life and literary works of H.P. Lovecraft, which leads us, in general, into the topic of the imagination. Eric, I want to tell you about this ongoing bedtime story that I tell to my children. You know, they stay here two nights a week, and we all sleep in my king-size bed together, and I tell them a story. And one of the overarching themes is basically both cats have discovered that the forces that they work for, while opposed to one another, are both evil and are to be resisted. But they're in a position where they can't just quit. You know, if they quit, the whole story comes to an end because the powers that motivate and guide them will retaliate and kill them. So they have to pretend to cooperate with their masters while at the same time working to subvert the overall plan of the masters. And the overall plan of the masters is to create, basically to enslave humanity by destroying the ability of people to exercise and utilize their imaginations. And I tell my kids that, you know, telling stories and listening to stories instead of watching TV or playing video games helps exercise and build their imagination and keep a vital element of their humanity alive in the face of, you know, many forces, institutional and otherwise, that are looking to make them into replaceable, identical cogs for large corporate machines.
If nothing lasts, then there's a conclusion, not a feeling, to be drawn from that observation. The conclusion to be drawn from it is then the felt presence of the immediate moment must be what life is for. And somebody who could take that perception and use it that way could immediately transcend all kinds of neurotic behavior, longings, regrets, doubts, fears. No, you just say no. The felt presence of immediate experience.
Tim, are you still there?
Part 1. How to win friends and influence people. You're not going to get any better on your own. You will never have more sex appeal, money, power, or happiness than you have right now. Or if, by some miracle, you do stumble upon a way to slightly improve your circumstances, other problems will inevitably arise that will more than sufficiently undercut the isolated improvement. The gurus, millionaires, models, and other dubious celebrities who want to sell you a better life in 12 steps, through positive thinking, or by means of an organic enema, are not your friends. There is only one system that you can rely on, but it's not a system of psychological principles, prayers, or investment strategies. It is a system of suppression, of alienation, and ultimately of death.
No. No. No, no, no. No, I don't like it. No. I don't like it.
Your life, as it exists right now, is insignificant, isolated, fractured, and cannot be saved. My life, as it exists right now, is insignificant, isolated, fractured, and cannot be saved. I'm sitting at my personal computer, listening to music selected for me by a sophisticated bit of code. After having put in a 10-hour day, sitting at a similar desk, I find myself trying to find words to string together in order to change it. I'm trying to find the right mood, the right tone.
Hey, easy, man.
Local languages, like local cultures and architectural styles and everything else, are designed to create, I think, an infantile sense of security. One of the bees up my rear end these days is the idea that culture is not our friend, that we have been very naive about what culture is and how it is something designed for the convenience of the species. And, you know, it could turn you into a janitor or a banker or a celebrity or anything else with no interest or concern for whether that's good for you. It plays with individuals, and you know, most people think, or at least here I think most people think, that when you get to be, I don't know, 30, 35, 40 or something, you have jumped all the hurdles. You got your college degree, you had some children, you made some money, you lost some money, maybe you had a marriage, maybe you had several. And anyway, people sort of get the feeling, well, I've done it. Actually, the major adventure still lies ahead. And the major adventure is to claim your authentic, true being, which is not culturally given to you. The culture will not explain to you how to be a real human being. It will tell you how to be banker, politician, Indian chief, masseuse, actress, whatever, but it will not give you true being. And maybe this is the voice of somebody who just turned 50 talking, but I thought it would get simpler. It doesn't, because this rejection of culture thing is the last and hardest step to take. And there are all kinds of impediments to taking it. The fact that in middle age, if you've played the game right, you get a lot of money. That's totally stultifying in most cases in terms of going forward to the next level. It's almost as though culture is an enterprise self-organized to buy you off at the moment when you might be most dangerous to its values and goals.
Okay, so in there you heard music prepared by Jesse Miller and something that I think he played on his Mystic Mind podcast, and I'll mention Jesse again before the end of the show. Also, Doug Lane reading from his short story, How to Cut Your Life to Pieces. There were two bits from Terrence McKenna. One, Jesse Miller tacked on to the end of the bit about me telling the story about the cats to my children. And the other I took from Lorenzo's Psychedelic Salon podcast. I don't remember which episode, but it was one of a recent series on the imagination. And in that last clip, Terrence talks about how culture is or seems to be a machine that is designed to buy you off at the moment when you might be most dangerous to its goals and values. And it buys you off with a stultifying amount of money that comes in middle age, at the time when you've got the experience and the intellectual capacity and the temperament, perhaps, to actually question and begin to undermine the stultifying effects of culture. And I myself received that payoff early, in my early 30s. And now I'm 41 and broke, and outside of the circle of people who listen to this podcast, of no consequence whatsoever. In fact, most of the people in my life who see how much time I spend at a computer think that my activities here are about as meaningful and useful as if I were spending that same amount of time playing World of Warcraft. And so, perhaps I'm in a position to be dangerous. And with that thought in mind, I want to read a poem from Khalil Gibran, published in 1918, and this was reprinted in the book that I mentioned earlier, Sacred Demise, by Carolyn Baker. And this is on page 49 of that book. Defeat. My defeat. My solitude and my aloofness. You are dearer to me than a thousand triumphs and sweeter to my heart than all world glory. Defeat. My defeat. My self-knowledge and my defiance. Through you, I know that I am yet young and swift of foot, and not to be trapped by withering laurels. And in you, I have found aloneness, and the joy of being shunned and scorned. Defeat, my shining sword and shield. In your eyes, I have read that to be enthroned is to be enslaved, and to be understood is to be leveled down, and to be grasped is but to reach one's fullness, and like a ripe fruit, to fall and be consumed. Defeat, my bold companion, you shall hear my songs, and my cries, and my silences, and none but you shall speak to me of the beating of wings, and the urging of seas, and of mountains that burn in the night, and you alone shall climb my steep and rocky soul. Defeat, my deathless courage. You and I shall laugh together with the storm, and together we shall dig graves for all that die in us. And we shall stand in the sun with a will, and we shall be dangerous. So as I say, that poem is on page 49 of Carolyn Baker's book. Now I'm going to read something to you from page 268. Carolyn Baker writes, "As I interact with others who are well aware of collapse and even preparing for it, I am most frustrated by those who focus on the logistics of preparedness in terms of learning skills, relocation, food storage, and other aspects of navigating collapse, yet ignore or neglect the emotional and spiritual dimensions of it, or insist that those are extraneous luxuries with which we cannot afford to be concerned. Some of these individuals still believe that they can survive in isolation and recoil when the topic turns to community and interdependence. And of course, my atheist and agnostic friends predictably roll their eyes when I mention sacred demise, while others tell me that in a post-collapse world, people will find their own spiritual path. Admittedly, it is far easier to preoccupy ourselves with logistics than to ponder the emotional and spiritual realities of collapse. What passenger on the Titanic, when it was time to count the lifeboats, would have stopped, breathed deeply, and asked herself how she was feeling in that moment? It is always much easier to manage a crisis than to be present with it. Yet the agonizing truth is that while many individuals will be able to physically navigate collapse, some will not be able to do so emotionally. There will be countless emotional breakdowns and suicides as the wheels fly off of empire. In my opinion, collapse will become psychologically intolerable for those who have no inkling of it, who are emotionally tethered to possessions, status, careers, and lifestyles that provide identity and security. Nonetheless, many individuals for whom collapse will be no surprise and who believe they are prepared for it may also succumb to psychological meltdown, especially if they have spent a great deal of time rolling their eyes when the spiritual and emotional aspects of collapse are mentioned." And now, jumping ahead a bit more to page 294, Carolyn Baker continues, "As I dialogue with my fellow earthlings who are aware of and preparing for collapse, I notice that without exception, they are individuals who are capable of contemplating their own and civilization's death. Their lifestyles perpetuate neither hubris nor heroics. They can talk about collapse and attend to the business of survival precisely because they realize they may perish. Most of them have a connection to something greater and more mysterious than themselves. Most have made friends with defeat, as echoed in Gibran's poem in chapter 4. Ironically, I do not find many among us who are morbid souls, clinically depressed, or what the culture of empire would call losers. We are all wounded, but the majority of us are also passionately alive, doing the work in the world that we feel called to do. So, as you can probably tell from the way I read that passage or passages from Carolyn Baker's book, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I have sent a couple of different requests to her to participate here on the Sea Realm podcast and receive no reply. If you have any pull with Carolyn Baker, do encourage her to come and share these ideas in her own voice with the Sea Realm audience. I would very much appreciate it. Now, if you ever see the show description, you know, the general description of the Sea Realm podcast, the first thing mentioned is this notion of a Vingian singularity, or a technological singularity, in which artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and other fruits of human ingenuity and the self-correcting, self-accumulating scientific method have just generated wonders that transform the world overnight and solve all of our human problems. Well, you know that I'm probably not nearly as sympathetic to that notion as I once was, and I have had guests on the program who are actively hostile to it. But let me just say that a technological singularity, if it occurs, will not create utopia. It might radically change the world. In fact, it certainly will, by definition, radically change the world. But it's not going to create utopia. And the forces that have set it in motion are not motivated by creating the conditions that foster human happiness, community, satisfaction. So preparing for the type of collapse that people like Jim Kunstler or Dmitry Orlov or Carolyn Baker are talking about is probably also very good preparation for a technological singularity. Both events, whether they spill out into our lives dramatically or gradually, will take from us the things that, if we live the unreflective, off-the-shelf life, define us and give our lives seeming value and meaning. These things will be taken from us one way or another, quickly or gradually. And I think the types of psychological and spiritual preparation that people like Carolyn Baker are talking about will serve us well, come what may. And I have a lot more to say on that topic, but it will have to wait for future editions of the Sea Realm podcast and for dates on the tour that I will be pursuing with Neil Kramer. We're going to start next week. First, we're going to Montreal. In the morning, we're going to appear on Ed Yersch's Tuesday Morning After radio program. And that night, Ed is arranging an event that will be held in some location in Montreal. I don't have the location committed to memory, but I will be posting to the show notes for this episode. And also, I think Neil Kramer will be posting the details on his blog, The Cleaver. The next day, the 16th, Neil and I are going to drive to Ottawa. And there we'll be meeting with a group of people and giving another presentation. And as I understand it, a delightful raw foods dinner will precede that, and there will be some music afterwards. Then I have to come back here and pick up my kids, and Neil will be heading back to New York City, where he's staying for the time being. But then in January, and the exact dates have not yet been nailed down, Neil and I are going to tour the Pacific Coast, and we're going to be doing stops in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver. Now, the first stop is Los Angeles, and Jesse Miller, whose music we heard in this episode of the Sea Realm podcast and who puts out the Mystic Mind podcast, will be organizing the Los Angeles event. If you are in the Los Angeles area and you are interested in attending that event, then do contact Jesse Miller. I'll put a link to the Mystic Mind podcast in the show notes for this episode, and from there I'm sure you'll be able to find some contact information for Jesse. In San Francisco, the venue is provided by Eric Boyd. Eric is a repeat guest on the Sea Realm podcast, and we're actually going to be presenting in his living room, which has a projector in it and seats 15 to 20 people. So we're looking for a crowd of 15 to 20. If you are in the San Francisco area and you would like to participate in that, and you'd be willing to help spread awareness of the event and fill the room, That would be very much appreciated. Please contact me, kmo@crealm.com. That is the letter C and then a hyphen and then realm.com. Thereafter, we head north to Portland. And in Portland, Doug Lane of the Diet Soap Zine and podcast is organizing both media appearances and a gathering, an event. So thanks to Doug Lane for that. Of course, tune in to the Diet Soap podcast every Wednesday. I do. And then the final stop on that leg of the tour will be in Vancouver. And Justin Ritchie, whom I've mentioned many times, not only on this episode, but other episodes of the podcast, will be coordinating and he'll be arranging for the media appearances in the day and then the live event in the evening. So if you would like to attend that, please contact Justin Ritchie and I will have his contact information in the show notes for this episode. Now, I haven't mentioned Seattle. I've got a place to stay in Seattle, but thus far there is nobody working on putting together an event, just a public appearance, securing the place and spreading the word and filling the room. So if you think that you've got an idea as to where we might appear in Seattle, and free venues are certainly the first choice, then please contact me. Again, kmo@crealm.com. And if you are in Seattle and you don't really have much of an idea of how to secure a venue, but you know a few people that you think might be interested, again, contact me and I'll put you in touch with whoever is coordinating the event. So C stands for consciousness. It also stands for community. And please take part in the community. And if you can help organize an event or help bring people to an event, that would be very much appreciated. Again, at the end of each event, Neil and I will be passing the hat in the hopes of securing enough funds to fill the gas tank and get us on to our next destination. But of course, donations will be optional. If you are broke but interested in this material, I would very much like to have you in the room and get the chance to make a personal face-to-face connection with another member of the C-Realm audience. Every member of the C-Realm audience that I have met in person has been a dynamic individual, somebody who certainly stands out from the sort of sea of anonymous people whose concerns I just find it increasingly difficult to connect with. Well, on next week's episode of the C-Realm podcast, if the recording went well, I will be playing an interview that I recorded with T.S. Bennett and Sally Erickson. They are the filmmaker and the producer behind a documentary, I guess it's a documentary, called What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire. And that documentary is praised many times by Carolyn Baker in Sacred Demise. And the topics that we will be discussing are very much in line with what you have heard in this installment of the C-Realm podcast. So if you liked what you heard this week, tune in next week. If you didn't like what you heard this week, well, there are a lot of other podcasts out there, and I'm sure there's one to fit your tastes. Probably more than one. Thereafter, I have to say, while I do seem to whip on the singularitarians quite a bit, deep down, I still have one foot in their camp. And I think that a lot of the people talking about peak oil and economic collapse and climate change and all of the things that really do seem to be coalescing into one great motivator for a shift in consciousness, be it a shift into oblivion or a shift to something more adaptive, they really are missing the element that this crescendo of technological evolution will add to the play. I think that technology, and that includes information technology, artificial intelligence, the sort of right now unsustainable, non-renewable forms of technology, they are moving in a direction where they can play a role in a world that does not have the same abundance of fossil fuel and the cheap, high-quality energy that it provides. And really, I think there is something that we're missing if we don't pay attention to the rapid evolution of technology. So it is my intention to get some of the people that are sometimes get derided as techno-utopians or techno-triumphalists onto the program and inject, or at least try to find, that element of that program and that awareness which fits into the larger C-Realm mimetic tapestry. And just by using the word mimetic, I am in fact tipping my hat to the singularitarians, as Richard Dawkins tends to be a patron saint among the singularitarians who, for the most part, seem to embrace a sort of atheism which I think of as shallow. I do definitely count myself among the ranks of the agnostics, and not just agnostics about God, but agnostics about really the nature of reality. But now I'm going way far afield, and actually sort of treading on the material I think that Neil Kramer will be presenting in our joint presentations. I really hope that you can make it to one of those presentations. I do want to meet as many C-Realm audience members as I can. I resist calling people who listen to the C-Realm podcast fans, because fan, while, you know, in our vernacular, it just means somebody who is enthusiastic about something, it is short for fanatic. And I think that if you've listened to a few episodes of the C-Realm podcast, you'll realize that fanaticism is the absolute last thing I want to engender in anybody. So do join me next week for episode number 184 of the C-Realm podcast. We'll be talking about peak oil, climate change, mass extinction, population overshoot. But join me in the weeks thereafter, and we will be talking about artificial intelligence, artificial life, nanotechnology, and just the rapid, rapid evolution and seeming convergence with something astounding. Do join me next week and the weeks thereafter, and until that time, stay well and stay dangerous.
Greetings, fellow denizens of the Sea Realm. This is Ed Yersch, member of the John Lennon Peace Community and host of the Tuesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. KMO and Neil Kramer will be visiting Montreal on the first stop of their North American road trip. If you're within traveling distance of Montreal, I invite you to join us for an evening of conversation at the OCL Artistic Embassy on the night of Tuesday, December 15th. They'll also be my guests on the Tuesday Morning After from 7 to 9 a.m. on the same day. You can listen in live or over the internet. Full details are at the show's blog, tuesdaymorningafter.blogspot.com. It's snowing in Montreal, and the city is beautiful. I look forward to meeting some of my fellow others in person.